Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, March 6th through Saturday, the 8th, feature guest conductor Gustavo Gimeno and a performance by principal clarinet Stephen Williamson. The program includes Second Essay for Orchestra by Samuel Barber, with Stephen Williamson, the world premiere of a CSO commission of Christopher Theophanidis' Indigo Heaven for clarinet and orchestra, and two works by Maurice Ravel, Rhapsody Espagnole and Suite No. 2 from the ballet Daphnis and Chloe. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on Christopher Theophanidis' Indigo Heaven, a work lasting about 27 minutes. The collaborative process can take many shapes, Christopher Theophanidis wrote after composing his violin concerto in 2008, but at its core, it's about getting someplace you could not get to on your own. The concerto form has long been orchestral music's ultimate vehicle for collaboration, particularly when the composer and soloist have a long shared history. There are many celebrated examples. Felix Mendelssohn wrote his violin concerto for his boyhood friend Ferdinand David, who had become Mendelssohn's concertmaster in the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, and who gave him practical advice throughout composition. As soon as the celebrated violinist Josef Joachim received sketches in the mail from Johannes Brahms, he realized the composer's new concerto was going to become an intimate back-and-forth conversation between two great musicians who had known each other since their early 20s. Christopher Theophanidis has been writing concertos for 3 decades, and he knows well how the form can explore the musical rewards of friendship. In 1997, he composed a bassoon concerto for Martin Kuxmann, whom he'd known since their days together at Yale University. He wrote his first piano concerto in 2006 for Donald Berman, whom he met earlier at the American Academy in Rome. But his new clarinet concerto, written for Stephen Williamson, is the result of a relationship that goes back to the time they were students at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, both in their early 20s. As their paths continued to cross at a festival in Houston, at the Aspen Music Festival in South America, they became and remained close friends. Although they had often bantered about the idea of a concerto for Williamson, the formal commission came from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra only in 2020. Indigo Heaven draws not only on friendship and common musical sensibilities, but also on a shared understanding of a particular landscape in the American West. Theophanidis was born in Texas, and Williamson, who was born in Denver, spent part of his childhood in Wyoming. In his first concerto for clarinet, Theophanidis explores the full range of the instrument's vocabulary of sonic variety and color, but it was Williamson who steered him to see beyond its common role as a lyrical voice. Theophanidis did not turn to classic clarinet concertos for ideas or inspiration. There are only a handful that hold a place in the repertory, but he began by asking Williamson what compositions speak to him. Over the months, they talked often as ideas started to gel. They began with an overflowing treasure chest of possibilities. At one point, they even considered having the solo part move through all the instruments of the clarinet family. Their only in-person encounter was a single week in Aspen in the summer of 2022, when they had the opportunity to experiment with ideas and test things out. All their technical rehearsal sessions that week were conducted unconventionally outside, in the vast mountain landscape that is in itself a partner in generating the soundscape for the concerto with its spare, open orchestration. The premiere of the concerto was scheduled for the Chicago Symphony's 2022-23 season, but that plan was derailed by Williamson's bypass surgery in September 2022. Although the composer and soloist made some adjustments, primarily to the solo part itself, during the unexpected hiatus, the concerto unveiled this week is essentially the same one they had originally planned to introduce. Indigo Heaven now takes its place in Theophanidis's large catalog, which includes both a symphony from 2009, as well as a chamber symphony that is a transcription of one of Tchaikovsky's string quartets, along with concertos for a wide range of instruments, from alto saxophone, his first concerto in 1994, and marimba in 2013, to violin, viola, cello, and piano, too, in 2006 and 2018. Theophanidis is a two-time Grammy Award nominee for Best Contemporary Classical Composition. A recording of his viola concerto won the 2021 Grammy for Best Instrumental Solo. His Rainbow Body, one of the most performed works in recent years, has been played worldwide by more than 200 orchestras. He's taught at the Juilliard School in New York and the Peabody Conservatory of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, and is currently on the faculties of Yale University and the Aspen Music Festival. Indigo Heaven is the first of Theophanidis's works to be performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And here is Theophanidis himself on Indigo Heaven. Indigo Heaven is a title taken, with permission, from author Mark Warren's wonderful post-Civil War era novel of the same name. In an affecting scene, the protagonist, a former soldier named Clate, sees a work of art of a visiting British noblewoman, Isabella, and finds a deep truth in the representation of nature in it, as if there is no barrier between the landscape's depiction and the reality he knows. The setting of Colorado and Wyoming is personal here, as clarinetist Stephen Williamson spent most of his early life between those two states, and the description of the sky at dusk, an indigo heaven, is haunting and tied to the beauty of the end of the protagonist's life. Each of the movements in my work takes its effect from imagery in the novel. The concerto is structured 1. Hypnotic, easy, 2. Vast, patient with a solo cadenza, and 3. Brilliant. Steve and I met at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York in 1990, and it has been a dream long in the making for us to do a concerto together. I am so grateful to the CSO for this opportunity. Words by Christopher Theophanidis and program notes by Philip Pusher on Theophanidis' Indigo Heaven. And now on to Maurice Ravel's Rhapsodie Espagnole, a work lasting about 15 minutes. Maurice Ravel was born in the French Pyrenees, only a few miles from the Spanish border, a geographical boundary he often crossed in his music. Even though his family moved to Paris while he was still a baby, Ravel came by his fascination with Spain naturally because his mother was Basque and grew up in Madrid. His Swiss father inspired in his son a love for things precise and mechanical that carried over into his impeccable music, provoking Stravinsky to dismiss him as a Swiss watchmaker. Rhapsodie Espagnole is among his best-known evocations of the Spain he visited so seldom, yet seemed to know so well. Much of Ravel's Spanish music was written before he had spent much time in that country, just as his La Valse predates his first visit to Vienna. One of Ravel's earliest pieces, written just after he left the Paris Conservatory in 1895, was a habanera for two pianos, the first indication that he would join that group of French composers, which includes Bizet, Lalo, and Chabrier, who have written some of our best Spanish music. The habanera was Ravel's first music to be performed publicly in March 1898, and despite the two pianists' inability to stay together, it made a strong impression on Claude Debussy, who was in the audience. He hadn't yet met the composer whose name would one day be linked with his own. Debussy asked to borrow the score, and his La Soirée dans Grenade, Night in Granada, written 5 years later, suggests that he studied it carefully. The suspicious similarity of the two pieces contributed to the eventual falling out between the composers. Rhapsodie Espagnole, the only work Ravel originally conceived as a concert piece for orchestra, is his first Spanish music to take advantage of his incomparable ear for orchestral color. In 1907, Ravel set out to write his first opera and his first orchestral score. Both works were Spanish in flavor. And although the opera, Le Espagnol, would take 2 more years to finish, most of Rhapsody Espagnol was written quickly as a set of 4 Spanish sketches, incorporating the 1895 Habanera as the 3rd, now in full Technicolor. The first movement, Prélude à la nuit, Prelude to the Night, is all atmosphere over a slow, soft, but persistent descending ostinato, F, E, D, C sharp. Malagueña is based on a type of fandango danced in Malaga, in southern Spain. The habanera is a slow Cuban dance in duple meter with the characteristic tum, ta-tum, tum rhythm that Bizet imported to Seville for Carmen. It has been suggested that Ravel's Habanera, virtually identical with the 1895 two-piano music, is based on a song his mother taught him. The final Feria is a brilliant festival, complete with castanets. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Maurice Ravel's Rhapsody Espagnole. And now on to Ravel's Suite No. 2 from his ballet Daphnis and Chloe. The suite lasts about 18 minutes. Maurice Ravel wrote home from his first tour of America in 1928, "I am seeing magnificent cities, enchanting country, but the triumphs are fatiguing. Besides, I am dying of hunger." Although he found the food alarming, Ravel traveled with his own favorite wines and cigarettes, and the pace relentless, in city after city, Ravel was reminded of the extent of his celebrity. At the matinee concert of the Chicago Symphony on January 20, 1928, Ravel accepted enthusiastic applause throughout the afternoon, a standing ovation at the conclusion of the program, and a fanfare from the orchestra he conducted. The second performance the following night started a good half hour late because Ravel, a famously impeccable dresser, discovered that he had left his evening shoes in a trunk at the train station and would not go on stage until they had been retrieved by his Scheherazade soloist, Lisa Roma, no less. The Chicago Symphony program included as its centerpiece the second suite from the ballet Daphnis and Chloe, which Ravel later called his most important score. Ravel wrote Daphnis and Chloe for Sergei Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe. It was begun in 1909, before Diaghilev's troupe had set Paris ablaze with a series of new ballets unlike anything the worlds of music and dance had known, starting with Stravinsky's Firebird in 1910 and climaxing with the scandalous premiere of The Rite of Spring in May 1913. Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe wasn't introduced until June 8, 1912, due to the composer's difficulty in finishing the score, compounded by backstage squabbling once rehearsals began. Although Daphnis and Chloe wasn't well received, that date isn't engraved in music history because this isn't music to provoke fistfights or catcalls. The principal players in the creation of Daphnis and Chloe were a distinguished group: Sergei Diaghilev, the impresario, Michel Fokine, the choreographer, Leon Bakst, the designer, Pierre Monteur, the conductor, and Vaclav Nijinsky and Tamara Karsavina, the leading dancers. Ravel worked tirelessly with Fokine to translate the most famous of the Greek prose pastorals into a scenario for ballet, the collaboration partly hampered, as the composer admitted, because Fokine doesn't know a word of French, and I only know how to swear in Russian. At first, there was also a serious difference of opinion about the style of the piece. My intention in writing Daphnis and Chloe, Ravel later said, was to compose a vast musical fresco in which I was less concerned with archaism than with reproducing faithfully the Greece of my dreams, which is very similar to that imagined by a French artist at the beginning of the 18th century. But Fokine had in mind the ancient dancing depicted in red and black on Attic vases. The result has something of the classical austerity of Jacques-Louis David's canvases, as well as the stunning clarity of Greek pottery. But it is both more sumptuous and subtle than either. In rehearsal, Fokine and Nijinsky fought endlessly over the choreography, and Diaghilev grew so tired of serving as intermediary that he finally threatened to cancel the project. As it was, he was forced to postpone the premiere twice, largely because Ravel was having trouble completing the final dance, on which, by the first rehearsals, he had labored for a full year. And then, when the music was delivered at last, Diaghilev's dancers were stymied by the finale's asymmetrical 5-4 meter. Ravel suggested chanting Sergei Diaghilev to each measure to help them keep their place. Ultimately, the rancor and tension of the Daphnis rehearsals led to a rift between Diaghilev and Fokine, who left the company at the end of the season. Daphnis and Chloe is the largest orchestral work Ravel wrote. He called it a choreographic symphony in three parts, and in its scale and developmental detail, it's as close as he ever came to tackling symphonic form. The work is constructed symphonically, Ravel said at the time, out of a small number of themes, the development of which ensures the work's homogeneity. Daphnis and Chloe is perhaps the greatest example of Ravel's remarkable ear for orchestral sounds and of the subtlety with which he shades and colors his canvas. The story is adapted from a tale by the 5th century Greek author Longus. Daphnis and Chloe, abandoned as children and raised by shepherds, have fallen in love. Daphnis charmed Chloe by playing for her on his panpipes. In the first part of the ballet, Daphnis earns Chloe's kiss. Pirates land and abduct Chloe. In part two, Pan and his warriors rescue Chloe. Part three reunites the lovers. Ravel arranged two sets of symphonic fragments from the ballet for the concert hall. The second suite, the one the Chicago Symphony played under Ravel's direction in 1928, includes the music of part three of the ballet. It opens with the sounds of daybreak, one of the most magical depictions of the gradual awakening of nature in all music. The birds, three solo violins, and piccolo sing as the shepherds stir, and the music is slowly warmed by the brightening rays of the sun. Daphnis wakens and joins Chloe. It is now full day. In a gentle pantomime, Daphnis and Chloe recreate the old story of Pan wooing the nymph Syrinx, the very event that Pan recalled and which moved him to intervene with the pirates and return Chloe to Daphnis. Pan's seductive flute solo is one of the most famous in music. Daphnis and Chloe eventually forget their roles and fall into each other's arms, declaring their love. All that's left is a celebration accomplished in an extraordinary final dance that took Ravel, perhaps the greatest perfectionist among composers, a year to polish and fine-tune. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the suite number 2 from Ravel's ballet, Daphnis and Chloe. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.